Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look at the legal landscape in Illinois as efforts are underway to remove the sitting governor, Rod Blagojevich, who is accused of selling President-elect Obama's Senate seat. We'll be joined by Professor Albert Altshuler, who has joined the Northwestern Law Faculty after serving as a distinguished visiting professor of law. And prior to that, he was a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School, and he specializes in criminal justice, and he's recently been following the legal troubles of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, who's expected on Monday to give a press conference, perhaps to resign or to take a leave. So we'll be looking into that. And then we'll also look then at the fate of the big three auto companies following the Senate's rejection of a bailout. There's a possibility and likelihood that President Bush will use the so-called TARPA funds to come up with the $15 billion. But we'll be talking with Daniel Howes, who's a business columnist and associate business editor of the Detroit News. He was based in Germany from 1999 to 2003 with the Detroit News as their European correspondent, reporting about European autos. Of course, there's a tension there between the southern states who have hosted the European automakers and the UAW in Detroit. And that will also be covered by Dr. Harley Shaken, who's a specialist in labor and globalization with a focus on auto manufacturing at the University of California in Berkeley. Those two gentlemen will be joining us to talk about the auto industry and the likelihood of the ripple effect of a failure and bankruptcy of one or two of these big three companies. And then we look at the fate of the Los Angeles Times, which the new owner, Sam Zell, who, with very little of his own money, bought with the pension funds of the employees, many of whom he promptly fired. So we'll be talking with Robert Scheer, who's a journalist, author, and columnist, who in 1993 launched a nationally syndicated column based at the Los Angeles Times, where he was named a contributing editor. And we'll look into the paradox that the Los Angeles Times and the other television and newspaper assets of the Tribune Company are all in the black, yet the Tribune Company filed for bankruptcy because of the debt that Sam Zell had acquired in order to buy the paper in the news in the first place. Let's now begin with the subject of the embattled governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, who it is expected, at least according to Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan on Meet the Press this morning. She said that she expected Blagojevich to step aside on Monday. Is that what you're hearing, Professor Albert Altshuler?
I hadn't heard anything until I heard it just from you, so I haven't been watching the news this morning, but I would believe the Attorney General.
Well, apparently there's a second possibility that he may take a leave. So I guess people who are waiting for this nightmare to go away, there's possibly another shoe could drop.
Well, either one of those would be very welcome developments. The Illinois Constitution does provide for the temporary disability of the governor, so he could step aside and let the lieutenant governor take over until his legal problems are cleared up.
Well, I guess from the point of view of President-elect Obama, who was basking in a lot of reassuring feedback from the public, I think there was a lot of relief on the part of many Americans that we sort of had an adult in charge, even though he's not quite in charge yet, who was very reassuring and actually engaging the American people. And suddenly, this lowlife politician has just taken all this away, it seems.
Well, I don't think so. I think Obama looks great out of this. I mean, he says, I had no contact with the governor at all about who was going to fill my Senate seat. And, I mean, think about that. Two politicians from the same party, it's his Senate seat, and he doesn't even pick up the phone and call the governor to say, here's who I'd like. I mean, that shows how wary and sensible Obama is. It stayed miles away from the guy.
But as you know, Professor Altshuler, the press is smelling blood. They're like sharks in the water because of the blanket statement that came out early from President-elect saying that nobody had anything to do with Blagojevich.
Well, he didn't say nobody had from his staff. He had contact with the governor, and apparently somebody did.
Right, and it looks like it was his chief of staff, right?
Yeah, but again, the Obama team comes out looking pretty good. Blagojevich says on the tapes, they won't give us anything but appreciation. Bleep them.
Right.
Well, that
hasn't stopped O'Reilly and others on Fox News for floating the story that Obama plans to fire U.S. Attorney Fitzgerald.
Well, Obama had said during the campaign that he wasn't going to do that, and again, I believe it.
Right. Well, I guess it just goes to prove that you don't necessarily. Some people in journalism don't have to deal with reality.
Yeah, I wonder if it's actually hurt Fitzgerald because he would have been a strong candidate for Attorney General of the United States, but if Obama had appointed him, everybody would say, "Aha, you're getting him out of Chicago. Aha, I'm
right.
Moving him up to get him out." But. That's speculation too.
Well, there's been some criticism of the U.S. attorney for the way that he handled his press conference, for being so categoric and colorful in talking about Lincoln rolling over in his grave. What's your feeling about how he's handling this? Because I get the impression that he really did act because this was so repugnant and they didn't want to have a U.S. senator chosen by somebody who was getting a kickback?
Well, two questions. Should they have moved when they did? I think the answer to that is clearly yes, for the reason you mentioned. You know, if you are hearing wiretaps and somebody says, "I'm going to shoot somebody," you don't say, "Well, I'll let him do it and then I'll have a real strong case." You got to step in and stop things in their tracks, even though there's some loose ends to the case. The other question, though, is about these tailored for the media sound bites about Lincoln rolling over in his grave and the state of Illinois, if it's not the most corrupt state in the union, being way up there and so forth. And I think those are inappropriate. If this case were ever to go to trial, and I don't think it will, I think there'll be a plea bargain, but if the case were ever to go to trial, the governor would say, "I can't get a fair trial. There's been too much prejudicial pretrial publicity." And although I don't suppose that the claim would go very far, it's a mistake for the U.S. attorney to give color to it by making his closing argument to the jury on the same day he makes the arrest.
And Professor Altshuler, when you were at the University of Chicago Law School, did you know or interact with President-elect Obama?
Yes. He and I had offices on the same floor, and we'd run into each other in the hallways and chat a little bit. I wasn't particularly close to him. You know, he was also a state senator when he was on the faculty, so he, you know, came in and taught his classes and was not a full-time presence.
And you just mentioned a plea bargain. What would be the basis of a plea bargain? What leverage does Governor Blagojevich have?
Well, he can save the state a long and complicated trial, for one thing. He does have some legal issues he can raise, technical legal issues he can raise about the charges that have currently been filed. And maybe he can bargain about resigning from his office. That's what Spiro Agnew did when he was vice president and was charged with misconduct as governor of Maryland. He got a very good deal by stepping aside.
Well, presumably, if the speculation on the part of the Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, who has been pretty forward in her efforts to get him to resign, I guess Monday's press conference, if it does happen, will be watched. a lot of curious people will be watching, probably to see whether it's expletive laden, right?
Yeah.
I wonder.
Well, he may be giving up a bargaining chip. The governor had apparently had a long meeting yesterday with one of the leading criminal defense lawyers in town, and I imagine that's one of the things they talked about.
So beyond the leverage that he has about getting out of the way and giving up the seat, and presumably getting some sort of favors for that, I understand that the genesis of this, this, at least the wiretaps, comes from an insider, a lobbyist who was working with the governor, who apparently was appalled by what he was either participating in or witnessing, and that led to the U.S. attorney getting the FBI and presumably the judge's warrant to do this. And also, I believe that the president-elect himself, apparently after the Illinois legislature passed an ethics reform bill, which the governor then vetoed, because it apparently required more disclosure with state contracts. President-elect Obama did lean on a colleague, his mentor, in Springfield to override Blagojevich's veto. So do you have any information on those two behind-the-scenes events?
Well, I think that's all public information at this point. So the bill was passed over the governor's veto, and apparently the governor then said, "Aha! I have till January 1st to collect contributions from state contractors," and put a lot of pressure on people to give contributions in the interim.
So that kind of frenzy is what did him in, with the clock ticking.
That was part of it. Although I actually don't know that there's anything wrong with her, you know, calling up your friends who are state contractors and saying you have only another month to give me some money.
Right, but I think didn't it get a little bit sort of nasty in the quid pro quo? Wasn't there a children's hospital?
There was a toll road deal. There was a contractor on a toll road project, and according to the complaint or the affidavit, they were waiting to see what contribution he made before they decided how much money they were going to give to this toll road project. And with the Children's Hospital, they were going to pull back money that had already been approved unless they got a $50,000 contribution from the head of the hospital.
So, Professor Albert Ulcioli, it's not a particularly pretty picture. Did you know? By the way, do you know anything about the insider, the lobbyist who apparently turned the state's evidence?
No, I don't. But
nevertheless, it seems that we'll be witnessing something tomorrow that maybe would end this agony. What do you think the implications are going to be for the president-elect's chief of staff, who is alleged did make contact? And of course, it's logical that he would have made contact to give him a list of these are the people we'd like to succeed President elect Obama's in his Senate seat that he's giving up. What do you think is going to happen there? Because his behavior, at least the press are saying he's behaving erratically, etc.
Well, I assume we're going to know more about it. The president-elect said he was going to put the facts together, and I think he said make them available to the public. I'm not sure he should. He should certainly make them available to the U.S. attorney, and it would be nice to know just what that conversation between Blagojevich and Rahm Emanuel was. I mean, you can imagine all sorts of possibilities. Blagojevich says, they won't give us anything but appreciation. I mean, it was the conversation, well, okay, these are nice names, what will you give us? Mm-hmm. And did Emanuel say, well, you'll have our appreciation? Mm-hmm. Were there suggestions made of quid pro quos and Emanuel rebuffed them? I'm sure he didn't agree to them. Mm-hmm. But did he rebuff them and fail to report that the offers had been made to the U.S. attorney? If he failed to report an improper solicitation for a bribe, there'll be some criticism of that, but I suspect that the conversation was at a level of generality that, although some people may make that accusation, it won't hold much water.
And in terms of the ambiguity of what the criminal charges might be, because it's sort of the tapes that with all the expletives deleted were reminiscent of Richard Nixon when the Watergate tapes were finally released to the public. There was a collective shock from most people about the salty language. But you know, people are entitled to be blowhards and make all kinds of ridiculous statements, but the law is based upon actions rather than words and intentions, isn't it?
No, it's based a lot on words and intentions. I mean, the crime with which the governor is charged is scheming to deprive the people of Illinois of the intangible right to his honest services. And prosecutors don't lose these mail fraud charges. I mean, what you would expect is a charge alleging a scheme that lasted from the day Rod Blagojevich became governor until the day he was arrested, and then an indictment will say this was part of the scheme and that was part of the scheme, and the sale of the Senate seat was part of the scheme. And at the end of a trial, the jury is just asked, was there a scheme? Not did this part happen or did that part happen? So you throw a lot of dirt at the wall, and the jury almost always, always in the Northern District of Illinois, seems to convict.
And so, what would that mean in terms of how long he'd be in Joliet?
Oh, I don't know. It depends. You know, I haven't looked at the sentencing guidelines. It depends on how much money was changing hands and so forth. Our last governor was convicted of mail fraud and is serving 6.5 years. So I think we're looking at least that much time, probably more.
And there's some speculation that the governor's wife, who's being characterized as something of a Lady Macbeth, and who was also heard on the tapes in an expletive-laden tirade, would she in any way be in any jeopardy, do you think?
Well, I think it looks as though she might be guilty of the same offense with respect to the Chicago Tribune that the governor's guilty of, but I'd be very surprised if she were charged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, enough is enough.
And in terms of what he's facing, at least what we speculate and what you've just speculated that the governor's facing, what kind of defense strategy would you advise?
Well, I don't think this case is triable. I mean, if I were his lawyer, I would advise him to negotiate and see what kind of a deal he could get.
So,
I mean, there are technical charges. I mean, at the moment, I mean, we're charging mail fraud, and we don't have a mailing. We don't have any mailing alleged. But the prosecutor will be able to come up with a mailing when he writes the indictment, I think. We have a charge of bribery. While the bribery statute requires that the bribe be a thing of value, is a newspaper editor's resignation from his editorial board a thing of value? There's some indication in the statute that it might not be, because it uses the word thing of value of $5,000 a little bit later, suggesting that maybe it has to be some of monetary value. So there are there are those lawyers' arguments to make, but I wouldn't think they'd be likely to go very far in this case.
Well, in closing, Professor Albert Altshuler, the candidate number 5, it turned out, was Jesse Jackson Jr., and he did a very preemptive press conference and was indignant, but he did meet with the governor the day before the governor was arrested, and he apparently is in some kind of negotiation with Patrick Fitzgerald, the special prosecutor. What's your understanding of I think he may be a dead duck, but legally, does he have any jeopardy?
Well, we don't know. I mean, the only claim is that one of his representatives came to the governor's staff and with what the governor's staff described as a pay-to-play proposal, and there's a very confusing passage in the tapes where there's a reference to raising $500,000 and then a second reference to raising $1 million dollars. Jackson has given a press conference saying, I didn't do that, and I didn't know that anybody was doing it on my behalf. So we'll have to see whether that's true.
Well, just in closing, much of the coverage of this is everybody sort of, you know, it's a bit like that line in Casablanca, you know, I'm shocked that gambling is going on in this establishment. Is it quite that entrenched in American political folklore that Illinois is ground zero for corruption.
Well, I was shocked by these allegations. I don't know. I mean, did you hear John Stewart's line about how we send a higher percentage of Illinois governors to the penitentiary than they send murderers to the penitentiary? I mean, it's something like if this guy goes down, it will be half of the recent Illinois governors who've been convicted of crime. But the charges in this case are very different from the charges against the got the last governor convicted. I mean, this is the last governor was they made a lot out of sweetheart deals. Somebody did a favor for him, and then sometime later, that person got a lease of a state office building or something of that sort. This stuff is really quid pro quo. This Senate seat is for sale. I've got to get something for it. I haven't seen anything like this case before.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Professor Albert Altshuler.
Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Professor Albert Altshuler, who is professor at the emeritus at the Northwestern Law Faculty. Previously was a visiting professor of law there, and then prior to that was a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School, where, as he mentioned, he was a colleague of President-elect Obama's. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and specializes in criminal justice and has been following the legal troubles of Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. And now let's turn to the subject of the fate of the big three auto companies following the Senate's rejection of a bailout, although there is an expectation, of course, that President Bush will release the last of $15 billion left in the so-called TARPA fund to bail out Chrysler and GM. I'm joined by Dr. Harley Shaken, who specializes in labor and globalization with a focus on auto manufacturing at the University of California in Berkeley, and Daniel Howes, who is a business columnist and associate business editor of the Detroit News, who from 1999 to January 2003 was based in Germany as the Detroit News European correspondent. Let me begin with you, Daniel Howes. You've suggesting that the rejection by the Southern senators of the bailout was payback time for the fact that the United Auto Workers supports the Democrats, no surprise there. You also suggest that there may be some other payback coming in the form of retaliation from the UAW with the so-called card check legislation. Just fill us in a little bit on that, if you will.
Well, I don't think there's any secret that what happened last week was, in fact, some payback by Southern Republicans who, oh, by the way, happen to represent foreign-owned manufacturers in their states, which have a record of being pretty anti-union for many years. Card check is one of the top priorities of organized labor in the next session of Congress, and for your listeners, that essentially means that instead of being required to hold union elections, secret ballot union elections, which companies typically like and the unions don't like, in part because it takes a long time, card check would enable unions to essentially organize, whether it's an auto plant or other businesses, just by having a certain percentage of the workforce sign cards. And some people allege they would be susceptible to intimidation and other things, but I think for purposes of this discussion, what I meant was it's a top priority for labor. I think it's possible that it could be passed in this first session of Congress. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the UAW go back down into the South and try again to, if not organize some of the auto plants, suppliers, and other kinds of businesses, because the United Auto Workers has a lot more members than just in the auto business. I mean, they're moving into all sorts of other kinds of pieces of the economy to organize and to raise dues and expand their membership base. But this is a very interesting thing that has happened last week. They clearly scored their points, the Southern Republicans did, with their constituencies, and I think to some extent the UAW scored some points with their constituency as well, because I think at the end of the day both sides knew that the White House was going to step in here at the 11th hour and take some money from the TARP to get these guys into the next year. You know, Vice President Cheney, I believe it was on Monday, went to the Senate Republican caucus and essentially told them, if you guys do not support this, you're going to go down as you're going to mark this party as one that has pretty much responsible for bringing down the U.S. auto industry.
Yeah, he used the analogy of Herbert Hoover there.
He did, and I think I think my interpretation is that was the only signal that the Southern Republicans needed at that point. That it was clear that the White House had done its due diligence. They knew that this would be catastrophic economically to a country that just lost 533 million jobs, or excuse me, 1,000 jobs last month, and was reeling, and they were going to do whatever they needed to do to keep that from happening. That kind of gave them a green light to take a stand on principle, because it's important to note here that this party had been shellacked in the most recent elections. Mitch McConnell, the minority leader, who ultimately did stand with these Southern Republicans, barely escaped a challenge from a UAW-backed Democrat in Kentucky. He was trying to decide which side his bread was buttered on, and it was pretty clear to him that the UAW was not going to do him any favors. Since he won re-election, he didn't have to worry about them.
Let me turn to Harley Shaken, because this card check legislation we're talking about, which essentially abolishes secret ballots and makes labor organizing easier, it's being met by a national television campaign, which I'm sure you've noticed, Dr. Shaken, which I've seen on television, which comes across as being all about democracy and freedom of speech, etc., but it's essentially aimed at curtailing the card check legislation, is it not?
That's certainly the case, and I think Dan House really put out a very compelling and thoughtful analysis of the politics of what went on with the bailout. In a way, the Republicans, led by Senator Corker from Tennessee, did not want to see this financial aid go through. They didn't want to take the political responsibility for it, but as Dan Howe points out, they knew the president would have to, because in a way this would be worse than Herbert Hoover. The Detroit auto industry survived the Great Depression. They might not have survived not getting this bill. What that does on the majority sign-up or card check provisions is it makes it much easier for the Democrats to introduce it early in the next session. You know, there were those who charged that it would be divisive, the economy's weak, why not wait? Well, the fact that the Republicans were so aggressive on shooting down the aid to Detroit, I think, gives the congressional Democrats a real incentive to move up the agenda on card check, and I think you will certainly see unions pressing in that direction.
But I don't understand, though, from the point of view of Southern workers, we're assuming here, at least I'm assuming, that Senators McConnell and Corker and the others are all responding to their constituents, and I don't understand how it could be popular with your constituents to carry the water of foreign car manufacturers at the expense of American workers. And furthermore, I understand that one of the reasons why the wages in the southern so-called right-to-work states auto plants, the so-called transplants, are reasonably commensurate with the UAW is that the UAW has been trying to organize, and that has driven up the price of labor in these places. So I would think that if you break the back of the UAW, all of those people down in Tennessee are suddenly going to see their wages cut in half, not to mention all of the auto parts people around the country being devastated.
Ian, everything you say, I think, is correct. But I think you have people that are having a shorter time horizon and perhaps are misinformed on this, and that's fed by a non-union culture in many areas of the South. They feel, many auto workers, I think, in places like Nissan or Toyota feel, well, if UAW compensation is driven down to where it's at our level, good for them. I mean, good for us, because we still have high wages down here, relatively speaking. But what happens if UAW compensation is driven down is the wages in the transplants, that is the foreign-owned automakers, are also going to be driven down. There was a memo that Toyota put out about a year and a half ago, an internal memo that was leaked that essentially said, well, you know, we've always tried to match UAW wages, but these are the highest industrial wages in the world. What we really need to be doing now is matching the prevailing manufacturing wage where we operate. So rather than the $26 an hour they now pay in Kentucky of Toyota, where it goes up to $30 an hour with profit sharing, they'd be talking about $13 an hour as the prevailing manufacturing wage in Kentucky. So that'd be a very sharp drop.
Well, if I might add here, Ian, I think the professor hits it pretty square on the head here. I would add a couple things. One is, to your question about how Southern workers might view this essential breaking of the union in the North, you know, all politics is local, and I think ultimately they're a lot more concerned about the economic well-being of their employers and those foreign automakers in their own states than they are about what's happening in Indiana and Ohio and Michigan. Secondly, the professor's, this is a very important point, is that there isn't a single transplant wage. Georgetown Toyota is certainly the highest, and it's the benchmark, and it's the one that's closest to the UAW's general scale. But if you go down into the newer plants in the south, the farther south you go, the lower that number gets, because they are already paying the prevailing wage. Whether they're in Tennessee or in Alabama or Honda down in, I believe it's in Mississippi, that's already going on. One of the things that differentiates that from the UAW is it doesn't matter. If you are a UAW guy working at a plant in Michigan, you're getting paid the same as the guy that's working in the GM plant in Louisiana and in Texas. That is not the case if you are a Toyota employee. You may be making one wage in Kentucky, another wage down in Alabama or Mississippi, and another wage in Texas, because it is more pegged to the prevailing wage of that market. And essentially, there's been a lot of talk about pattern bargaining and pattern wages, and in the UAW, everybody gets paid the same. Toyota has broken the pattern in this country. They essentially matched it at Georgetown, Kentucky, and then they've broken it in other markets, and they've essentially set the new template for how auto wages are going to be set, I think, in the United States going forward.
Well, hasn't the UAW, though, agreed to a two-tier? Last year they agreed to a two-tier wage structures and to put some of these healthcare costs in a trust, so that, you know, it's not... About 2011, GM will be basically on the same plane, will they not?
They will, but what's important to note here, and I hear this from a lot of the members who bring this up to me in emails and things like that, important point here is they don't get the benefits of those lower wages unless they hire new people. They're not going to be cutting the wages of the people, the guy that's got 25 years and is making that UAW wage. They're going to be lower for the people that they hire in, and it's different depending on the company. GM has a different kind of deal under the current contract than Ford does. Ford has a different deal, and it gets very complicated that your listeners don't really need to know. But the real important point here is that they don't really get the benefit until they start to move this demographic bubble through these companies and then start to hire on the other side. Then they start to get that kind of wage compression that the professor's talking about, and they become more even on the wage field with the transplants.
And Dr. Holly-Shagan, I'm just still trying to get a handle on the, if you will, the mentality of the Southern workers in these right-to-work states. Maybe the South, which still talks about the war of aggression from the North, confuses the union with unions. But at the end of the day, and perhaps, you know, being a red state, maybe they getting their information from Fox News. They honestly believe that it's not the problems in Detroit, not as a result of the management, but of these overpaid workers. So what's your understanding of this mentality?
Well, I think it's coming from a number of sources. It's coming from history, from the way people grew up in the South, where unions were heavily attacked. The companies involved have really pulled out all stops, you know, to tell their workers, look, the problems in Detroit are caused by unions. Do you really want that here? Do you really want, and this is almost a quote from what's been reported, the Yankees telling you what to do and having to pay the Yankees to tell you what to do. So they really create a stereotype and make it appear that Southern workers would be inviting some alien third party into this, versus having a choice as to whether or not they want a union. And if they have it, it's people that would represent them and speak for them, not some external force. But be that as it may, it isn't simply Fox News. It's the vast power of these companies to really put out a stereotype about what unions would do. There's a larger danger here. I mean, clearly, the Detroit auto industry is in a deep crisis. In fact, the entire industry is in a crisis. But we're in danger here of potentially undermining the economic miracle of post-World War II America, where an industry such as auto, we had very productive firms and growing productivity translating into higher wages, and that became the foundation of our middle class. The auto industry has made more than its share of mistakes, but there's little question that this was one of the world's most successful industries in its better days, and that success translated into a middle-class lifestyle, not simply for auto workers in Detroit, but for people throughout L.A., where these wages and benefit patterns spread throughout the U.S. economy. We're at a turning point now as to whether that model survives or whether our approach becomes who can pay the lowest wages, what the market will bear for that.
Well, just in closing, though, Daniel, let Daniel House, who's the business columnist, associate business editor of the Detroit News, by all means follow on. But I just wanted to ask you in closing that I spoke early this morning with a former head of public relations for Chrysler and for Ford, who's a Republican, and he complained that he'd spent $1,000 of his own money at a fundraiser for Mitch McConnell a year ago in Detroit, and feels bitterly betrayed by the Republican Party.
Of course, I know who that is.
I'm sure you do. And you know, we had, for example, George W. Bush's chief of
right.
staff, Andy Card, was a Detroit lobbyist from General Motors. None of these people have, over the years, for example, instead of lobbying for what would seem to be intelligent on the part of General Motors to lobby for single-payer national health care or something that take the burden of the health legacies off
right.
them, they lobbied against catalytic converters and every other thing. So give us a sense of how Republicans are unpopular in Detroit.
Well, the current administration has an abysmal record when it comes to the auto industry. I've written many columns and blog items about this. You know, it was only about, we were about 7 years into eight years of Bush before this current White House started to pay any attention at all. This president was more willing to have his picture taken in a Nissan truck plant down south, or meet with the Detroit Red Wings who won the Stanley Cup, or spend time again getting his picture taken with I think it was the Honda engine that won the Indy 500, than he could be bothered to meet with the CEOs of GM, Ford, and Chrysler. That went on. That dance went on for close to a year. They've had a terrible record of any of these kinds of issues, and the president then moved on with his own agenda on hydrogen fuel cells and other things in terms of energy security. Essentially, surprised this industry and with his positions that were then taken by congressional Democrats, and we got the energy bill of 2007. So, you know, this administration has not been positive and helpful at all, and I would say in general is very unpopular, almost as unpopular, I suppose, as some of the Democratic Party. Washington has proven to be no friend of this industry, certainly throughout a lot of this crisis, as we've seen. I want to go back to one thing, if I may, very quickly, to the point the professor was making about why Southerners take this take the position that they do. There are two auto industries in this country. There's the northern based, Detroit based, unionized big three auto industry, and there's an auto industry in the south. And I think the most compelling argument of all for the Southerners is the actual fact of those two industries. One is declining, it is in crisis, it is cutting jobs, it is closing plants, it is stressing communities. The other one is growing, it's drawing more investment, it's opening plants even now through the recession. In Bob Corker's Tennessee, Volkswagen's going to be opening its first plant in a generation, employing roughly 2,000 people. Of course, it's going to be thanks to $577 million in state and local incentives from the state of Tennessee and the city of Chattanooga. But I think people look at the facts. I mean, at the end of the day, people make rational economic decisions, whether it's to buy a car or it's to support an industry or companies within an industry. And I think that's one of the most compelling arguments for people who are, frankly, making decisions in their own economic self-interest, some of which here in Detroit are not very popular. But the facts are the facts, and I think that's the way people are behaving.
Well, just in closing, they have to add to that Honda's sales are down 30% and Toyota stock has dropped by 50%. So all is not well in the overall automobile industry.
No question.
I thank you both for joining us, Dr. Harley Shaken and Dan Howes with the Detroit News.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thanks very much.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Harley Shaken, who specializes in labor and globalization issues with a focus on auto manufacturing at the University of California in Berkeley, and Dan Howes, who's a business columnist and associate business editor of the Detroit News, where he covers automobile issues. I'm now turning the subject to the fate of not the big three, but of the Los Angeles Times, which the new owner, Sam Zell, bought with very little of his own money, but with the pension funds of the employees, many of whom he's subsequently fired. And I guess the real paradox here is that the Los Angeles Times and the other newspapers of the Tribune Group own, and the television stations are all in the black, yet the country company or the Tribune company filed for bankruptcy this week. So Robert Scheer, clearly the disconnect here is pretty profound, is it not, between companies being in the black and the overall company going under because of the debt taken on with the guy who bought it.
Yeah, but you know, it's really interesting. I've been reading all these stories. Now you got this Wall Street lawyer who's in jail. And
Madoff, you mean?
No, this new one, I forget his name.
Yeah, Madoff. He made off with all the money.
No, but I'm not talking about Madoff.
No, you're not.
$50 billion. I was just reading about another one, you know, who was swindling. He only did $48 million instead of the billion. But, you know, and he's a Yale, Harvard Law School guy and everything. And just trying to follow all these financial shenanigans, I realized that probably the greatest indictment you can make of the mass media, including the LA Times in its best of times, was we never covered this stuff. Never really covered it. And now, you know, this great newspaper falls victim to the very same shenanigans that are destroying the rest of the country. And you know, who are these people? What do they trade and sell? What do they do? What do they know? And they became to be entrusted with the fortunes of everyone's, you know, our dreams, our jobs and everything. And I don't think what Sam Zell did is anything different than what's been done for the rest of the economy. You know, it's all this funny money stuff. It's all these scams. And we don't know about it because there wasn't any great journalistic motivation to cover it, because the very same people who owned the big media, in fact, were part of this rat race and game and, you know, corruption. So, you know, that's my basic take on it. I don't know what makes Sam Zell tick. You know, but he doesn't seem to be very different than the rest of them, you know, the guys who run Goldman Sachs or Citigroup or anything else.
Well, indeed, I think you could go back to our previous segment on Detroit, and there's a lot of similarities with Sam Zell's Tribune bank-finance to buy out of the Los Angeles Times with Cerebus, the group that bought out Chrysler, headed by billionaire Feinberg and the former Secretary of the Treasury, John Snow. Chrysler's suffering the same problem. You know,
right.
It's the debt burden that's killing them.
In the end of the day, it has very little to do with how the market is supposed to work under the old Adam Smith idea, which is, you know, good work is rewarded, and, you know, with sales and jobs and so forth. Well, as you point out, the Los Angeles Times to this day still makes money. And so it's no fault of the people working there, the editors, you know, the people who have managed it, the reporters, you know, on every level, people really knock themselves out for this newspaper. And, you know, you got one group of shysters after another coming in and trying to squeeze it one which way or other and not thinking very much about the community that they serve and the people who work there. You know, just something happened in my own relation to the paper. I worked there for almost 30 years, 29 years in one capacity or another. And then we got this form letter saying, you know, you no longer have retiree health insurance. You can go with Secure Horizons, you know, which no doctor seems to want to take. And this isn't the news story. No one writes about it. I turn to my colleagues, my former colleagues, what's this about, you know? We have to decide by the end of the year, do we, you know, but we don't seem to have a choice anyway. And so the media, they're not even good at covering their own self-interest. It's really quite bizarre. And, you know, and that's the way I sort of look at this whole a financial meltdown, and I see the Tribune thing is just a part of it. I feel very sad about it because I think the LA Times is a great newspaper, and I think there are a lot of people, good people, still working there. And I don't know what you do without a good, solid newspaper, you know, in a community. I think it's going to be a tremendous loss, but I don't see anything to stop it.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may. I'm speaking with Robert Scheer, who's a journalist, author, and columnist. His work's been published across the country for the last 30 years. In 1993, he launched a nationally syndicated column based at the Los Angeles Times, where he was named a contributing editor. That column ran weekly for the next 12 years and is now based at the San Francisco Chronicle. And after leaving the Los Angeles Times, Robert Scheer founded the award-winning Truth Dig, a web magazine that provides in-depth coverage of current affairs as well as other content assembled from a progressive point of view. Robert Scheer has written 8 books, and his latest, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Now, I understand that given that Sam Zell bought the paper with little of his own money, but on the basis of the pension funds of the employees, many of whom have been fired, there is a lawsuit within the former employees of the Times who are suing over that very matter. I believe that the automobile correspondent, Dan Neal, is actually on the paper, is also joined in that suit, which probably makes his life a little uncomfortable. Do you have any information on that, Bob Scheer?
Yeah, well, mostly what I know about it I get from Henry Weinstein, who was the legal affairs writer, and he's also part of the lawsuit. And they're challenging the right to use the pension fund and use the resources, basically, of the employees to pull off this purchase. And, you know, but if you ask me, can I unravel it? Yes, if I devote months now to it, I can do that. But why should it be such a mystery? Why wasn't it covered when it was happening? You know, where's the media? Why don't we know about these things? Why didn't we know about what happened with the bankruptcy bill? Which made it so much harder for people, individuals, to go get protection with bankruptcy? Why didn't we know about the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, the Financial Services Modernization Act, the Telecommunications Act? You know, all of this stuff was happening, and you know, while I'm very concerned about the passing of the old media, the fact is they weren't so great. And they did. The one thing they were really failed was to cover corporations, cover corporate machinations, cover lobbying. They just didn't do it. And so now we are the victims of it, people who work for newspapers and love newspapers. Yeah, we're the victims of it. And if you ask me for a quick soundbite on how it all happened, no, I can't give it to you. And one reason we started Truth Dig is we can actually look into these things. So I did ask Steve Wasserman, who was the book editor who got pushed out at the Los Angeles Times. He wrote a marvelous piece on all this crap that was happening and why they were going downhill. You know, but these things are kept murky by design. Very difficult to sort out. I never knew what Mark Willis was doing before the Tribune Company. I didn't know why he was rewarded with $50 million or something when he left after really messing up the paper. Tribune couldn't have taken over this paper if the old Chandler family hadn't screwed up after they forced Otis out. So this has been a downward decline. And you know, yes, there are objective factors. Yes, the Internet, you know, is a counter market for classified, et cetera, et cetera. But as you point out, the L.A. Times and most of those other Tribune properties are making money. And, you know, and so who's going to pay now? It's like the auto workers. They're going to pay for the failure of the executives who ran the auto companies. You know, it's their fault. And that's what's happening here now. People aren't going to get their buyout money, you know, and they're not going to get retiree medical insurance and so forth. And the fat cats who designed all this crap, you know, they're going to have their golden parachutes. They have their resources, you know. It's very sad. And let me say something. While I'm a big fan of the Internet, and I think Truthdig does a great job, and we're not the only ones, fact is we can only support a little bit of reporting. My colleague, Zway Kaufman, who's the publisher, you know, we're out there scrambling like crazy. We hired Chris Hedges to be a columnist. He used to be the New York Times bureau chief for 8 years in the Mideast. He's great, but we can't afford to field Mideast bureaus. We've sent a couple of reporters to Iraq. We sent one to Afghanistan. But we can't raise the funds to rival what the newspapers used to do, and we don't have a business model to do that. Google's not going to pay for it, you know. The bigger websites aren't paying for reporting. So I think, you know, while I blame the Sam Zells for this decline, I'm not happy about it. You know, I'm very worried. You know, I don't know how you cover news if you don't have reporters.
But, Robert, just to focus on your critique of the mainstream press for not covering these behind-the-scenes business machinations that have essentially brought down the global economy and basically this new administration is trying to, you know, analogies are being made with Roosevelt in 1932 and the New Deal, etc. Does that mean then that this vast group of business reporting outlets out there like Bloomberg, CNBC, PBS has a business show, all of the, did they all fail as well? Are they too close to the industry? Is that the problem?
There's no question about that. You know, the trades covered it well from an insider's point of view for what their readers wanted to know. Was it good for, you know, it's good for us? Are there tax breaks for us? Are we going to be able to do something, you know, in terms of the industry insiders? But I can tell you, I was still writing my columns for the L.A. Times when the Financial Services Modernization Act was passed, and I wrote about it, and the commodity futures, and I wrote about it. Before that, I wrote about the telecommunications. I think that's why I lost my column, frankly. I think I was forced out, not so much that I was critical of the Iraq War, but that I was writing about all this, you know, these deals that were being made that I didn't think would help the consumers or the country, and I was quite critical of what was being done. But I would go to these hearings and rarely see another reporter for a mainstream organization. The desks, also, we don't go near that. It's boring. It's complex. What was called business reporting was basically writing from the corporate point of view. You didn't have much consumer reporting. You didn't have, you maybe had one labor writer, somebody like Henry Weinstein, who was once a labor writer. You had others, but usually there'd be one. Nancy Cleland was another. You know, you had one or two at any given moment, but basically the business side of these organizations, whether it was the electronic or print, basically wrote it from the corporate point of view. Unless there was some egregious scandal and somebody's going to jail, then maybe they would cover it, always late. But as far as, you know, why were these laws being written? The Telecommunications Act is a perfect example. You know, 1996, it was not covered in any serious way. And go back and try to find any decent coverage of the end of the Depression era regulation, which is what the Financial Services Modernization, the Graham Leach Bliley Act, and the commodity futures, that stuff wasn't covered at all.
Sure. Well, just in closing then, Robert Scheer, what could be the fate of this local resource? I mean, my fear is that the New York Times is well distributed here in Los Angeles, and if they published a local movie guide, there'd be less of a reason to buy the Los Angeles Times.
Well, the problem is not just the New York Times is in trouble also, and so even is the Wall Street Journal. There is, you know, a problem with the model. You know, and will your readers pay for the kind of expensive journalism that has to be done? And the Internet has not found an alternative model. I can tell you this because I'm in the business. We sent Bill Boyarsky, who was the best political reporter at the LA Times, when he got pushed out, we sent him to cover this last election. It was hard to scratch up the money, and we did it with the Nation Institute in cooperation. And I, you know, I have a lot of respect for Arianna Huffington and the Huffington Post, but, you know, they've got to start spending money on sending reporters. And that's true of, you know, of the other larger sites. And, you know, people should be putting pressure on groups like Yahoo and Google and so forth, you know, that are so powerful on the Internet and are making lots of money. But, you know, you got to support journalism. And right now it's mostly aggregating news services and other pieces of information. And as I say, you know, we, I don't want to toot our own horn, but our model at Truth Diggers, we are actually trying to put people in the field.
Sure.
That's hard.
Well, and you can't keep recycling what other people already write,
right, yeah,
if there's less and less of the people in the first place writing stuff.
Exactly. And so the problem is not just the LA Times. It's a problem that all of print journalism are going to have. And in fact, even, you know, what used to be the main broadcast channels, it's more now gravitating towards cable and that crap. You know, and so, you know, where's the money coming from for reporting? It's really a big issue.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles this morning, Robert Scheer.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Robert Scheer, journalist, author, and columnist, who had a column at the Los Angeles Times for 12 years, was there for 30 years, and we're talking about the fate of the LA Times. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, and the assistant producer, Elliot Fong, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. Also, special thanks to Michael Rose for his background on Detroit and the auto company's bailout.